So after we discussed the top-down nature of jazz and how it was pushed in the 1910s and 1920s last week, a lot of people wanted to know the real story of hip-hop and if that was suddenly kind of pushed top-down or if there was some agenda, especially given the fact that it's taken over rock in recent years. And in this video, I'm going to share some of my investigations into that topic. Before we get going, I'll remind people, pick up a course at the academic agency, the Trivium, Foundations of Research, if you want to know how to do research, as thorough as the research you're about to see. If you're into literature, Foundations of Shakespeare are available, many other courses as well. But let's get a move on here, because one of the things I wanted to look at was actual sales. And I had to fight with Grok, the AI thing, Elon Musk's AI. I mean, I could have used a different one, but Grok is the one that I have been using recently. And I had to fight to get accurate numbers, because one of the things that Grok is liable to do is it keeps on taking shortcuts and making estimates. So these are actually accurate figures. It took probably about 20 different run-throughs to get these actual numbers based on actual sales reported by the RIAA and actual gate receipts of, or actual revenue of tours, okay? And as you can see, the general trend in its pomp, in its heyday, rock was selling, in America this was, about 400 million albums, okay? That's for the entirety of the 1980s, whereas rap only sold about 10 million. Rock was raking in, and these figures are adjusted for inflation. Rock was bringing in about $5 billion, okay, whereas rock was bringing in about $5 billion. Rap was only bringing in about $50 million. That was in the 1980s. Okay, go forward a decade and you can see that the trend, rock drops off a little bit from 400 to 320. Rap massively increases from 10 to 150. The tours of the rockers actually go from strength to strength. Now we're looking at $6 billion. Okay. And rap is now $200 million. Okay. Then we carry on going forward, and rock has declined further in the 2000s, down to 200 million albums sold. Rap has almost caught up now. It's 180 million. Whereas if you have a look at the tours, rock even makes more money. Now we're up to $7 billion in dollars tour revenue. Rap has increased from 200 to 800 million. If we go forward to the 2010s, the actually there's a rebound in the 2010s for rock sales. I can actually explain what that was in a moment. That was partly due to streaming services coming online. So some portion of that is the back catalogue of the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and various other bands, 60s, 70s, 80s bands, their back catalogue getting millions of plays on streaming services, which has given a rocker kind of kick up in the 2010s. And then if you have a look at rap sales, they've now overtaken for the first time, only slightly overtaken, but they have overtaken. But then in the tour stakes, it's 8.5 billion now, plays 2 billion for rap. So tour revenue significantly higher for rock in every single decade. But there are reasons for that. One of the reasons, for example, is the price of a ticket, the demographics involved, older people like Rock, so they can more afford to go to, you know, spend $300 to go and watch AC/DC or something like that. So there's all of those factors in there as well. And then if you have a look in the 2020s, we have Rock sales are, well, this is just 5 years now, but you can see that the trend is, if we carry on from this point and just double these numbers, Rap will be up to 300, whereas Rock is on 160. So the trajectory of Rock going down and Rap going up continues. Yet the Rock tours are still making more money than the Rap tours. Okay. Although, if we, given that this is only for half of the decade, we should expect the decade to end with Rap tours on about four billion. Okay. So that is astronomically increased, whereas the Rock tours are increasing, but possibly at a slower rate. Okay. So that this trend that, or that Rap has overtaken Rock, or hip hop has overtaken Rock, is not just a perception. It is based on actual facts. Okay. Now, why did this happen? Was this like a bottom up phenomenon? Did the vibe shift? How did this come about? Well, this is what I'm going to be taking some time to look through in this video. And it's worth saying that you better strap in, because there's quite a lot of information here. Okay. I had a look at the UK trend, by the way, and quite astonishingly, the UK Rock tour market is almost as big as the US one. If you have a look at that, I mean, those numbers are phenomenal. So the UK, obviously a very big touring destination for rock acts. Although the same story is broadly true there. Whereas the rock tours are kind of going up, you know, at a slower rate, the rap tours have made a lot more money in recent years. Okay, they're up to 1.2 billion in the UK market now. And similar tale with the rock sales and the rap sales. Again, for some reason, there was a dip in rock sales in the 2000s and then an increase in the 2010s. But again, a lot of that is explained by streaming services being part of this calculation. I can't remember if I've got a slide in here, but basically what happens is that you take so many streams of an artist, so and then you convert them at a rate of 1,500 streams equals one album sale. That's how they do it, okay? So, I don't know, let's say the Beatles have got 10 million streams this year of all of their stuff. That translates into whatever 10 million divided by 1,500 is. That is actually counted as a Beatles album sale, okay? And if you have a look at... So what I've done here is... So just to explain, this is the overall trend, okay? And then what I've done is I've gone decade by decade. So I'm going to go through the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s to look at who were the top acts in each decade, okay? How many records were they selling? And then who were the money men behind them? Who were their record labels? Who did those record labels answer to? What was the power structure behind each of them? And specifically, who were the key decision makers at each stage of the way that gave emphasis to rap or to rock? Okay. These are the questions we're going to be looking at. Okay. For full disclosure, I know people will know that I am not a fan of jazz in general. Okay. Especially of the kind of free form modal experimental jazz. You know, I've never been a fan of that. However, in the 1990s, I was a pretty big hip-hop fan, a rap fan, also a rock fan, okay? So in the interest of disclosure, this is not this is a value-free analysis. It's not driven from a place of disliking rock or disliking rap, okay? It is really a question, an empirical question. How is it that you got from a situation where rock was that big in the 1980s and rap was not that big in the 1980s to a situation where they reverse? What was it that changed these two positions, okay? And if you know anything about this channel, I'm all about elite theory. This is a bit of applied elite theory. The question is, who is the organized minority behind this? Okay. Who were the specific individuals who made this happen? The answer is almost never, oh, there was a vibe shift and millions of people suddenly changed their minds. They had their minds changed for them using largely the techniques that we talked about in the jazz video. Okay. So if you have a look at the top five rock and rap albums in America in the 1980s, the top rock album was Thriller by Michael Jackson. You could argue that was a pop album, really, but let's take it. And then License to Ill by the Beastie Boys was the top rap album. Then we had Guns N' Roses, Run DMC, LL Cool J, Eric B. and Rakim, and Yo Bum Rush, a show by Public Enemy. Those were the big rap acts in the 80s. Whereas on the rock side, you've got Jacko, Guns N' Roses, Bruce Springsteen, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, okay? And you can see that the combined sales of the guys on the left here on the rock side absolutely dwarf the emerging rap act in that period. We can also have a look at the UK scene. Rap smaller in this country than in America for obvious reasons. Rock bigger, of course, especially because there's so many rockers are British. But here, Dire Straits, Jacko's Bad sold particularly well in this country. U2, Fleetwood Mac, and Def Leppard. And all the same acts on were the ones, you know, the same rap acts that did well there did well here. And if we have a look at the touring acts, one of the things that we will see going forward, because this is true of pretty much every decade, the Rolling Stones, still an absolute monster as a live act. They were out, you know, they got 150 million in the 80s versus 5 million in Run DMC's kind of banner run on top there. Springsteen, U2, Bon Jovi, all big live act. Van Halen was going, and they were outselling Grandmaster Flash, LL Cool J, Public Enemy, Beastie Boys, okay? And the figures are just astronomically higher in the 80s, okay? So how do we get from this situation of cultural dominance of rock in the 80s where the emergent culture, rap, ends up taking over, okay? One of the things I've done is I've broken out who were the big record labels pushing rap in each of these decades. Now, one of the things to bear in mind is that in the world of music, you have quote-unquote independent record labels. So famously in rap, there was Def Jam, okay? But you also had like Sugar Hill Records, Tommy Boy, Profile, Enjoy, okay? These were the biggest five record labels that pushing hip hop in the 1980s. But notice how Russell Simmons in Def Jam actually reported in to a man called Lyle Cohen, okay, who owned a record label called Rush, okay, and Rush was an intermediate, was in turn a kind of subsidiary of CBS Records, okay? So Def Jam ultimately reported into CBS, all right? In the music world, these massive record labels that own all of the other record labels are called the majors, okay? Sugar, and every single rap label was basically owned by or distributed by or answered to in some way a major. So Sugar Hill was pushed by MCA. Warner Brothers had Tommy Boy, Polygram had Profile, and EMI had Enjoy. Okay. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at is you're going to keep an eye on, like, who are the guys at the right at the top of the tree? Who are tier one decision makers? So if you have a look in this hierarchy, Lyle Cohen is a tier two decision maker, and Russell Simmons of Def Jam, one of the people who in kind of mainstream accounts of hip hop will say, well, Russell Simmons and Def Jam, they were absolutely vital in mainstreaming hip hop. People will talk much less about the likes of Lyle Cohen or Walter Yetnikoff. Okay. And so we're going to be keeping an eye on these top line decision makers right at the top of the tree there, at the top of the majors, because ultimately these are the true power brokers in this world. They can make or break any particular record label. Okay. So we're looking at not only a Def Jam pushing, let's say, Run DMC, we're also looking at Rush pushing Def Jam or CBS pushing Def Jam. Okay. There are some other top down forces that were at play at this time. Okay. MTV Raps, which launched in 1988, was actually part of a push to show more hip hop videos on MTV. And in the 1990s, MTV was a very important vehicle for how people kind of got to know about music, especially how teenagers got to know about music. They'd watch MTV. And at some point, MTV downgraded rock in their heavy rotation and upgraded rap. Okay. This happened with the launch of MTV Raps. And then as the 90s and the 2000s progressed, MTV more and more became kind of an urban station. Okay. Obviously, Def Jam, who we've just talked about, they signed LL Cool J, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy. Okay. There was a radio airplay expansion. Okay. Basically, they increased exposure of rap outside of the, you know, the traditionally black communities, right? Station, K-Day, you know, you would have had it all around the country, for example. Hip-hop culture growth, yes. And really important, really, really important was the major label investment, that is CBS, Warner, okay, basically funding the smaller labels in order to try to exploit the rap market, okay? Now, note, I am not saying that hip-hop was entirely a top-down thing. There was actually an organic street poetry culture. There is an organic hip-hop that developed from the streets. What I'm looking at is its commercialization, its capture, if you want, by the system. Okay, and when it's captured by the system then decides which artists get promoted, which labels get promoted, and that is how, that is in the nature of what I would describe as top-down control. Okay, and also ultimately, if you think of the person right at the top of the chain, they actually have, you know, it's not like they've got two dials there saying, right, we're going to turn rock down and we're going to turn rap up, but it kind of is, because they ultimately have to allocate budgets and make decisions on who gets which slots at the end of the day. Okay. So when I'm talking about top down, I'm talking about these ultimate power structures and decision-making nodes in the system. As we move forward into the 1990s, okay, we can see that rock was deprioritized, okay, by MTV. There was a backlash against grunge in the mid-90s due to Nirvana. Basically, like, that song Spells Like Teen Spirit were everywhere. Nirvana had tons of copycat acts. By the time you get to Foo Fighters and post-grunge and all of that, the kind of, I don't know, there was also kind of whiny tone that crept in after a while with all of that stuff. So, you know, there was a bit of a overkill when it came to that genre. And then there were mergers of lot, you know, Sony and CBS merged, Universal and Polygram merged. So there was a kind of monopolistic element to it where, you know, it's not just true of rap, it's true of all, and rock, it's true of all music, basically. So here are some other things. But anyway, let's continue our journey here through the decades. So here we have the 1990s, top album in America on the rock side was Nirvana's Nevermind. But have a look at the rap record now. The top rap record, MC Hammer's Please, which is a commercial, very commercial album, selling just as many records as Nirvana. Next record down, 10 by Pearl Jam. And then, okay, half of that was Dr. Dre's Chronic, okay? Then we had Use Guns N' Roses still there, 7 million. All Eyes on Me by Tupac, 5 million. Life After Death by Biggie, 5 million. Jagged Little Pill by Alanis Morissette, 7 million. Trust me, if you grew up in the 90s, that album was everywhere. You couldn't stick on the radio without hearing Alanis Morissette. Okay, so it's not like the rock act weren't pushed in the 90s. They were, Sweet Child of Mine. I mean, you can't get away. And Nirvana, of course, you couldn't get away from those acts either. And the reality is that I had a copy of all of these. I had Illmatic, I had Life After Death, I had All Eyes on Me, I had Chronic, but I also had Nevermind, I had Use Your Illusion by Guns N' Roses, I had Jagged Little Pill, Metallica. I mean, you basically had them all, right? If you were into music, okay? I had records by some of these other people too. Coolio, Puff Daddy, Wu-Tang, R.E.M. I was never a Pearl Jam guy, but, you know, they were. I knew people who liked Pearl Jam. So it's not like if you were around in the 90s, you didn't have exposure to these things, because you did. But you were kind of getting hit by both sides, or at least I was, as someone who was into rap. I should say being into rap growing up in Wales was a little bit unusual, right? It was a little bit unusual for someone to be into hip-hop at all. In South Wales, but still, it was still accessible. Okay, I did have to go to Cardiff to buy records on import and things like that as well. I remember, there was quite a few albums I could only get, in special record stores in Cardiff back in those days. But anyway, if we have a look at the tours, Rolling Stones 640 million, still going absolutely strong. And they were outselling MC Hammer at a scale of like 10 to 1 still. U2 plays Snoop Dogg, again, ratio is 10 to 1. Metallica plays Wu-Tang, ratio 10 to 1. It's funny how that happens. Pearl Jam plays Puff Daddy, and R.E.M. plays Coolio. And there you can see the... rock is still dominant as a live act, and it's still dominant in terms of record sales, but rap is catching up. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, right, I wanted to look at the overall picture, okay? I wanted to look at the overall picture here, but then I wanted to drill down into the top act, okay? Is because we can use the top five to see kind of what's happening right at the most popular level, okay? Whereas this early charts that I had, if I can find them, hold on. These earlier charts that I have here basically show the depth, okay? So it could be that you get five rap acts that were really, really popular, but then downstream there's nobody's really listening to any other act, or it could be strength in depth, okay? And what you're seeing in the 90s is some of the more popular acts here, like Notorious B.I.G. as an example, okay, or Dr. Dre or MC Hammer, right? These guys had some mainstream penetration. But if you go down the list, if you go like 50, 20 artists down or whatever, how many people are listening to or buying Mobb Deep Records or EPMD or something like that? Maybe you'd have to be right really quite into rap to know about those. Whereas in the rock chart, you could go 20, 30, 40 down, and there are still people down, you know, in those, still selling quite a lot. Okay, so that was the reason for breaking out the top 100 versus just the top 5. Okay, just to explain my methodology a little bit. Then if we go to the UK, obviously Oasis and Britpop was big in this country, so you get Oasis as the top selling album, and a little bit questionable categorization of grok that I should have seen, which has sullied this chart a little bit. They have classed Prodigy's Fat of the Land as a rap album. That was a dance album, let's face it. So that shouldn't be in there. Kind of annoying that it's done that, but anyway. Then Alanis Morissette, Viv, Green Day, do you remember them? R.E.M. So those were the biggest selling rock albums. And then Gangstar's Moment of Truth, another album I owned. Enter the Wu-Tang, of course, Ready to Die, and Doggy Style. Okay, so kind of surprised that Gangstar's Moment of Truth sold that many units. I mean, I bought it, but, you know, I was in a tiny minority of people who were into rap. So then if you have a look at the touring acts, finally, the Rolling Stones knocked off their perch by Oasis. We see Wu-Tang, Snoop Dogg, and Coolio, and Cypress Hill. Remember them? U2, Pink Floyd did a tour in the 90s, apparently. And REM. So still quite a margin bigger for rock than rap in the UK. And if we have a look at the record labels in this decade, this is where things start to get really quite interesting, because Bad Boy, who you'll know from Puff Daddy, right? P. Diddy, who's been in the news recently for, you know, various crimes he's alleged to have committed. If you go back and watch Devin Stack's video on Odyssey, on P. Diddy, he basically has a breakdown of like P. Diddy's entire career as a record executive. One of the prominent people in there is a man called Clive Davis, okay? Clive Davis was the boss of Arista, and Bad Boy was actually a subsidiary of Arista, okay? So even though it looks like, or to the world, it looked like Puff Daddy was an independent record label owner, actually he answered to a guy called Clive Davis. And if you watch that P. Diddy video from Devin Stack, you'll see just how kind of astroturfed or pushed Bad Boy Records were by Clive Davis, and also some of the, let's say, the greases, the palms, right, that P. Diddy needed to grease in order to gain that position for his record label. Some of the, let's just say, the favors he had to do for the likes of Clive Davis, all right? Kind of quite a tawdry affair, but that's show business, right? But Clive Davis was not the top of the tree. He was still only a tier two power broker, because he ultimately answered into Tommy Mottola. Okay. Suge Knight, the great rival of P. Diddy, actually answered into a man called Jimmy Levine. Okay. And his label was Interscope. So Death Row was a subsidiary of Interscope, who ultimately, Jimmy Levine answered into a man that we're going to be talking a lot more about as this video progresses, Doug Morris. Okay, Doug Morris, the CEO of Universal. Universal Records, the biggest of all the record labels. Okay. Def Jam, Russell Simons. Okay, like we talked about, he answered into Lior Cohen, right, who answered into Polygram. At this point, it was a chap called Alan Levy. Jay-Z, Rockefeller, okay, he answered into Def Jam. And they had a company, Warner Music. Mo Austin was the guy at the top of the tree. Do you remember the No Limit Soldiers and Master P and all of that? I certainly do. Terrible record label, really. They answered into Priority, which was run by Brian Turner, which in turn answered into EMI, which was run by Jim Fifield, or Fifield, okay? So we've got a chain of command here, and we can actually see there's consolidation as these maps of the record labels keep going. The amount of majors, or the number of majors, keeps going down. Okay, still quite varied here in the 90s, but as we go forward, we'll see that that situation changes. Okay, and just bear in mind that name that we saw, Doug Morris, because he is the chap who is pictured on the front. And if I had to say who is the person responsible ultimately for rap taking over rock, it's pretty much Doug Morris. Okay. Let's just have a look at what happened in the 2000s, because this is the transition point, really. One of the major developments in the history of rap was the Marshall Mathers LP and the explosion of Eminem as a mainstream star. And you'll see that even as a live act, he was the top. He was the top in the album sales. And the role of Eminem in selling rap to a reluctant middle America cannot be overstated, because he pretty much was the guy who did it, who broke that market. Over in the album side, you had Linkin Park dominating. They had the top two albums. Norah Jones's Come Away, speaking of jazz, by the way, that was pretty much ubiquitous in the 2000s. I remember it in pretty much every cafe you went to. You know, do you remember that song, Don't Know Why? She was everywhere. Green Day, American Idiot, it was around, and Evanescence. And I think you can, one of the things that you can see is that objectively speaking, you know, you've gone from, you know, some of the acts here, you've literally gone from, you know, some towering names in music to likes of Linkin Park and Evanescence. I mean, not a great time for rock in general. So that's possibly one of the non-top-down factors that, you know, the actual acts aren't that good, okay? And it also, like, Evanescence, I mean, I remember it was that Nickelback. They were all kind of quite whiny as well, which, I mean, I remember not liking any of that stuff. And then over on the rap side, you've got Eminem, Nelly, 50 Cent was big, of course. And, well, I mean, it's those three acts dominating. But over in the touring side, Rolling Stones still strong. Coldplay were a big live act and continue to be to this day. Metallica, Red Hot Chili Peppers, they were big too. And then you can see the names there. Jay-Z has started to come up, 50 Cent. So rap has actually overtaken rock for the first time in this decade at the top end. In the UK, still rock dominated. I mean, they've classed Dido, kind of a Coldplay. These are kind of middle of the road or more poppy kind of acts, really. James Blunt, Coldplay, Keen. Oh, I mean, these aren't great acts, really. And then you can see 2001 by Dr. Dre, great album. So, yeah, I mean, this was the picture here. But this is the table, really, that we need to focus on in terms of what were the factors of hip-hop being pushed so much, okay? Now, I want you to study this. Aftermath, which was Dr. Dre's record label, answered into, as we saw, Jimmy Iovine. But Interscope had been acquired in the meantime by Universal, okay? So Jimmy Iovine answered into Doug Morris. Jay-Z's Rockefeller record label answered into Island Def Jam, our old friend Lyle Cohen there. But Lyle Cohen answered into Doug Morris. Bad Boy, that was Sean Puffy Coombs, P. Diddy, right? They were still with Arista. A guy called L.A. Reed had come in, and they answered into Sony. So Bad Boy was not a Universal guy, right? He was. They were with Sony. G-Unit, that was 50 Cent's record label, actually answered into Shady Records, which was Eminem's record label, which ultimately was kind of affiliated with Dr. Dre's Aftermath, right? Which answered into Interscope by Jimmy Levine. And if you keep on following the chain up, Interscope, Jimmy Levine answers to who? Doug Morris. Cash Money, okay, he had a big record label. Birdman was the executive of Cash Money, which is a big record label, which answered, he answered into a subdivision of Universal, right? Brian Williams, whose boss was Doug Morris, okay? Now, this is where this is really important. In the 2000s, the top five rap record labels, okay, four of the top five, so only P. Diddy of the five top record label owners, did not in some way answer to this man. Where is he? Doug Morris, okay? Here is Doug Morris. As you can see, an extremely powerful power broker in the music industry. So when I saw, okay, by doing this exercise, when I saw that Doug Morris was so powerful, okay, I mean, in the world of rap, Doug Morris could make or break any act. He could make or break any record label. He could make or break any career. He could make or break anybody, pretty much. Not just in the world of rap, but in the world of music in general, because look how powerful being the CEO of Universal is. So I had a look into his activities, what he did, some of the decisions he made. And it is true that when he was coming up in the 1990s, he wanted to change the focus from rock to rap. Okay. Some of the reasons that he gave for that, I mean, he was saying that, well, rap is a growth market, is how he framed it. And looking at the numbers, you could see, well, yes, as a percentage increase, but in terms of raw sales, if you were Doug Morris in 1995, for example, looking at some of those stats I just had, I would just presented you, the rock act was astronomically bigger than the rap acts, okay, in that first 15 years of hip hop. So he must have been looking at it being like, right, there's something about the business model of having the rap record label sitting underneath me, okay, and having a guy like Jay-Z answering into one of my guys, okay. Some of the reasons that I've seen people kind of, you know, people trying to explain Doug Morris's decision making for why this happened. Apparently, the cost of touring with a rock band is quite high. The cost of instruments for the production studio is more. You need session musicians, you need instruments, you need all sorts of equipment. Whereas rap actually is pretty cost effective, right? What usually a rapper is a solo artist, okay? So you don't get these problems of like the band changing and things like that. So you're dealing with a single individual, okay? They don't have any equipment, just a microphone and a bit of production equipment. And usually the actual number of producers, the hit makers, if you want to put it that way, are relatively small. So like Dr. Dre, as we saw, not only is one of the major producers in hip hop, but he's also an executive as well. So he's a money man. Okay. Jay-Z obviously is a rapper. Okay. But he is also a money man. So in the world of rap, you can also combine these two roles, okay, of the artist is also the businessman as well, okay? And this, for whatever reason, is easier for the industry to deal with than the, you know, your stereotypical rock act, okay, your Rolling Stones, your, you know, who could split up or they could fall out or they could make demands and they're expensive and, you know, they can be difficult to work with and all this sort of stuff. Whereas the rapper, in many different ways, is, you know, just easier to manage to some extent. Obviously, saying this in the week that Kanye West has just done what he's done, obviously, even with rappers, there's a certain amount of, you know, risk involved. Clearly, Kanye West now is breaking the mold. Now, I will say that following the decisions of Doug Morris has been quite interesting because, yes, he was generally responsible for massively pushing rap in the 2000s. If you remember that period where Jay-Z was everywhere and it was like he's the king of New York and there was all of that stuff, that was all Doug Morris, okay? But one of the other things that Doug Morris did, you know, is that he started to push really quite heavily, you know, as the boss of Universal. And later now, I think he's gone to Sony. I think, don't quote me on that, but he's at one of the other majors now. So he's still active, this guy. He wanted to push a kind of a composite rap R&B sound, okay? So think about Beyonce, or think about Rihanna. Think of that way, that sort of stuff. That R&B thing where you have the R&B, the big R&B act, and then like Jay-Z comes in for a verse, okay? That general model was the Doug Morris model, okay? So Doug Morris is not only basically responsible for making rap bigger than rock, he is also responsible for the ubiquity of that Beyonce, Rihanna kind of R&B thing, that urban R&B thing where you get the, you know, it's Beyonce featuring Jay-Z, say, or whatever, okay? And there's all sorts of weird collaborations, like, you know, it's Rihanna featuring Ghostface Killah. You know, it's kind of this weird thing where the aggressive elements of hip-hop that were to the fore in gangster rap in the 90s are massively toned down to be made friendlier for female audiences, for non-ghetto audiences, for non-hardcore audiences. And instead, you get this composite R&B rap thing all wrapped up into one package. And that's the thing that's become ubiquitous. Really, if Doug Morris is responsible for anything, it is that. It is that whole phenomenon of the, like, the, it's like the teenage girl who's into Beyonce, but is kind of also into rap because, like, she knows Jay-Z through Beyonce, something like this, okay? That's Doug Morris. And it's top-down. I mean, it was a top-down decision really made by him sometime in the late 90s. He decided that this is what was going to happen. And this is all like open information. You can read about this guy in your own time, okay? For better or for worse, this came down to the decisions of just one man, okay? It's not, I mean, not just you know, an organized minority, just the tastes of this one guy, okay? What his motives are, you'll have to ask him, okay? But it really does come down to this. Going forward in the 2010s, and one of the things that we should look towards is the, I guess you'd call it the Doug Morrisization of hip-hop, because now we're not dealing so much with the Notorious B.I.G. We're dealing with people like Drake and Kendrick Lamar, right? These are much less hardcore gangster-type personalities, and it's much more R&B kind of sound and focus, and it's kind of friendlier, and it's, you know, it's a little bit... I mean, they tried it once with the MC Hammer, back in the early 90s, as we saw, right? But that had a backlash from the homies. They didn't like the MC Hammer, okay? There was a backlash against that. Whereas now it's been done in a way where they've kind of got everything, okay? Look at the dominance of Drake here. On the rock side, you've got Adele, I mean, Lady Gaga, Coldplay still, Imagine Dragons, And still, just about in the 2010s, the rock, well, I mean, if you can call it Del Rock, I mean, if we're being, Grok is being a bit fast and loose here, but generally speaking, you can see the rock side is still slightly outselling the rap side in the 2010s. Then we have, in terms of the live acts, Rolling Stones for the first time not in there, but U2 still going strong, and U2 outsold Drake. Look, Kanye West, as you can see. And then moving forward, we can see in the UK, much similar picture, really. The rock is still held out longer in the UK because rap is not only just seen as like, you know, it's just not, it's been seen as like American, obviously. Okay. So there's been a little bit more of a kind of residual cultural resistance against rap in this country. But still, look, Drake still selling like 1.2 million records here. Just not as many as Ed Sheeran or Adele. Okay. Or Arctic Monkeys, even. Yeah, and you can see Coldplay, you know, big live act in the 2010s. And then if we have a look at the intermediaries and the majors, right? Lucian Grange is the man at Universal now because Doug Morris has gone elsewhere. Forget where he's gone now. I think he went to Sony, but the Rob Stringer is mentioned here. And you can see it's much the same situation. So Lil Wayne, right? Lil Wayne actually answers in to Birdman at Cash Money, who answers into Universal. So it's still all basically locked up with the majors. I notice Jay-Z has gone to Rock. He's now got a record label called Roc Nation, which is Sony now. So Jay-Z's obviously gone from Sony to Universal. Maybe Doug Morris took Jay-Z with him, you know, I don't know. Kanye West, look, answered into Def Jam at one point, who ultimately answered into Universal. I'm guessing Kanye West is truly independent now. He doesn't have to deal with all of this kind of power structure. And, you know, whether you love Kanye or hate Kanye or whatever you your views of him, he has talked about all this stuff quite a lot, right? He is actually on record as talking about some of these power structures that we're talking about here. I can see that chap Lyle Cohen, right, is still around. Clearly, Lyle Cohen loves working at Tier 2 because he's never moved up to be like the big Tier 1 major boss. Maybe he just likes it in and around there in the intermediary. And then just moving forward to present day, last 5 years, you know, they're classing Taylor Swift as a rock act, which it's going to have some people tearing their eyes out, but you can see Coldplay, Imagine Dragons, you know, and the big rap acts now. I mean, think about how kind of chart friendly somebody like Drake or Kendrick Lamar is compared to Wu-Tang back in the day, as an as one example, right? Or, you know, pick any of those 90s acts. And clearly they're less hardcore, right? They have been Doug Morrisized, if you want to put it that way. All right. UK scene much the same. And as you can see, the UK rap live revenue is coming up now. All right. Yeah. But the rock sales are still pretty strong here compared to the rap. And then if we have a look, in terms of the majors, it's still Universal, Warner, Sony. Ultimately, everybody answers into one of these, one of the majors there. And it's much the same. Okay. So what is the bottom line of this video? The bottom line is due to the structure of corporate music in current year, the actions of individuals like Doug Morris can have very, very, very wide sweeping consequences. Okay. It is not actually true that good rock music is no longer made. Okay. A lot of people were saying, well, you know, rock fell off, or rock hasn't been good since the mid 90s, or whatnot. That is not actually true. There have been tons of really very clever, great kind of rock music made since 1995, as one example. Okay. But it is not given priority by the major. The majors have decided, following the model set by Doug Morris, who, and clearly the other majors started copying after he made that decision, that they're going to go with this model of the R&B singer, right, with the featured rap star, and that this is going to be like their model, okay? This is like the soundtrack to the regime in current year, okay? So, yeah, I really don't think. And what is the evidence that it's not organic, okay? The evidence that it's not organic and that it is top-down, I would suggest is shown by the persistence of the live revenue, okay? Yes, there is a demographic factor whereby there are some older people who've got disposable income to spend on some of the tickets. You know, they charge a premium to play big venues like Wembley, say, you know, ticket to watch Rolling Stones is quite expensive, and so on. But what those tour revenue receipts show is that there's still an appetite to listen to rock, okay? I had a look at streaming data. I had a look, I really dug down quite deep into this. And the gap is not as big as you'd imagine, okay? A lot of the streaming numbers are wrapped up with a couple of songs that get played, like a lot, okay? So Notorious B.I.G., okay, ranks quite highly in streaming stats. But when you look into it, it's just people playing Hypnotize over and over and over again. So that one song has had like billions and billions of streams, okay? Which then artificially inflates Notorious B.I.G. When you start drilling down into like, well, how many people are listening to this act or that act or this act or that act, you actually find not only like current rock feature quite prominently, but acts like the Beatles or Queen or like this. They also have individual songs that are played billions of times on these streaming services. So there's a little bit of a kind of alchemy to it where you can slice and dice those numbers in different ways to come up with kind of, you know, there's a bit of a smoke and mirrors in the current music industry, I would suggest, with how they present this data. Because by rights, I mean, I was having a look. I was like, who's the best-selling rock act then? Oh, it was like Beatles. And it's just like people listening to lots and lots of Beatles songs. So it's kind of, you know, you have to like take away all of the old artists and see, well, who is being pushed now? You know, the Beatles haven't been a group since the 60s. Why is it still the Beatles, right? Clearly, there's an appetite of younger people, because who, let's face it, it's not boomers streaming Beatles songs, it's younger people. So there's clearly an appetite for rock in the audience. It's just not pushed at the moment for whatever reason. Okay. And I would suggest that the initial push in the first place was not driven by consumer trends. And if you have a look at live receipts, it doesn't seem to be top down either, because clearly, if you're looking at those numbers, which act would you book? Would you book a rock act or a rap act, you know, to sell out your venue? You're probably still going to be looking to AC/DC or Def Leppard or something to sell out Wembley, not one of your rap stars. So anyway, this is just something that was interesting. There's lots and lots of other stuff I could have gone into. I try to keep it like very data driven. Okay. Apologies if it was a bit boring for some people, but it was worth drilling down into this level to just kind of uncover how kind of deeply embedded this is. Okay. Let me know if you have any questions. If there are enough questions, I could do a follow-up, because there was so much material here. I mean, there's like a whole like human side of this that I just didn't get into. Okay. There are many, many aspects of this story. But what I wanted to laser focus in on was the power of just this one man, okay? Anyway, yeah, I'm really interested to look at comments for this one. Pick up the Trivium, and I'll see you again tomorrow, folks. Well, in fact, I'll see you. I'll see you later on for reviewing Adam Curtis. Catch you next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.